Mini episode 587 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini-episode number 587. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris coming at you today. And we have an excellent conversation on tap with one of our favorite recurring guests from throughout the history of the show. It's former Congressman Joe DiAguardi. He is the proprietor of truthingovernment.org as well as DiAguardi.org and other fine causes as well. Joe is someone who served in Congress in the 1980s and subsequently did a lot of work overseeing our nation's work in rescuing the failing savings and loan agencies in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Joe, as somebody who is a trained accountant, is someone who always brought that eye to government, and it's always a pleasure to be able to talk to him. We're going to be breaking down today the state of the Republican field coming out of the debate last week in Cleveland, and more about that in a moment, but yes, I was there on the ground as some social media pictures will attest. I was outside there for a little bit, but we're going to talk about that part with him. I know Joe's preference is always to talk policy, and we'll certainly do some of that and get into what the candidates should be talking about. But as far as taking an overall look at the state of the race right now, Joe being somebody who knows many of the key players involved in what's happening right now, being from New York, he has definite insights and I think experiences with a number of the people involved in the race. So we want to get into that part of it and talk about whatever light he can shed on what's going on, what are some of the different choices being made strategically both last week and going forward as the campaign continues to develop. Always a pleasure, like I said, to bring on our great friend, former Congressman Joe DiAguardi, an honor as always. Joe, welcome back to the program, sir. Great to have you with us.
Hey, Rick, what an introduction. My God, I feel like I'm not only back in Congress, I feel like I'm Speaker of the House here.
Well, we
he's got his problems, by the way. Everybody's got their problems today, including the Speaker.
Yeah, yes, they do. It's a very, very interesting time in politics. I want to flesh out a little bit right at the start here because I've always been very, very upfront about putting my biases on the table, which I frankly wish more people would do in media rather than pretend that they don't exist. In this campaign, and of course, I was photographed down there. As I said, it showed up on social media. With my Rand Paul sign, I personally, and FDH does not endorse anybody, I personally have gotten behind Rand Paul. Like his message, he tracks closest to where I am as far as tracking off a number of boxes, whether it be common sense, non-interventionism, not pacifism, but common sense, non-interventionism, some of the excesses of the national security state, certainly concerns about government spending. On down the line, he checks off more boxes than almost anybody who's ever run for president, as far as for me personally. So on the issues, I'm a Rand Paul guy. I have to ask you, because we've talked about this previously on the show, I know that you're a very good friend of Ron Paul's from having served in the House with him. You've endorsed him for president previously. Where do you stand on this? Are you behind Rand at this point, either formally or informally? Or what's your stance on his candidacy?
Well, before we start, you know, picking horses in this race, let me just say a couple of things. Number one, I don't have any biases except one. I'm a certified public accountant. I'm the first CPA ever elected to the U.S. Congress, House or Senate, Republican or Democrat, and my bias is for honest accounting. You know, this is America, and what is more important in America than good information? And what is more important when you have an economy that's going backwards and forwards and we still have the Fed, you know, printing money and keeping interest artificially low than understanding hey, what is the real financial condition of the United States of America? What is the real annual deficit and the real national debt? You know what? No one knows. You know why? The politicians control the accounting system. Why? Because they don't want to tell you the truth, that the debt is so much bigger than they're saying it is. The debt clock is a joke. I'm the one who convinced the guy who owns the building, Seymour Durst. He was a client of mine. I was, don't forget, a partner at Arthur Andersen, a tax partner. I did a lot of consulting. I got to meet Seymour. Very difficult guy to talk to. You can imagine by looking at some of his sons today, but one son. The other two sons are great because I met with them. Not when I ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010, I tried to convince them to put two clocks. One, the cash basis, which is now up to over $18 trillion, and one on generally accepted accounting principles, which the Securities and Exchange Commission requires under penalty of, you know, criminal justice penalties. If you try to sell stock to the public and don't use the real accounting system. And that debt is over $80 trillion right now. And these are not Joe DiGuardi's numbers, Rick. These are the numbers I get from the annual financial statements that my bill in 1990 required the U.S. government to publish. It was the Chief Financial Officer Act of 1990. I put it in 1987. President Bush signed it in November of 1990. And you know what? If you had to look at that way of accounting, which is what the accounting profession, don't forget what the accounting profession is. It's been around for 100 years, says you should do, which the SEC says, all right, we'll let the accounting profession, you know, rule the roost on this, on these accounting principles, but we got to enforce them. Fine. So the accounting profession stepped aside. But guess what? Congress has not adopted it for the budget process, for all the annual statements that come out. And I'm not saying let's abandon the cash basis. You need that to know how much cash you have. Every corporation in America, Rick, wants to have a statement that says, here's my cash flow, and here's, on an economic accounting basis, what my financial condition is, including all liabilities. Now, why don't we do that in America? Now, getting back to your question. So my bias is for those people that understand this. Now, I have great respect for professionals like, you know, Rand Paul and who was the other guy that just left the Congress that was a physician? We had two great physicians.
Colbert. Yeah.
Senate.
Colbert.
One of the most bright people you ever could meet in your life, got so fed up, he gave up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's not my style. I never give up. I could lose an election, but I've been going since 1989, Rick, with American tradition. You know what it is? Active citizenship. I set up two foundations. One for human rights to save the Albanian people from genocide, and one to save America from a humongous debt the next generation is going to inherit that they don't even know what the amount is. It's called Truth in Government. Look at, have your listening audience look at my website, www. And spell out Truth, T-R-U-T-H-I-N, government.org, and look at the 2.5-minute whiteboard animation that cost me $15,000 to put on. As soon as you open up, you have no choice. You're going to see it. But it's lovely. It tells you in a short amount of time with beautiful graphics what we're doing to the next generation. It's intergenerational fraud, and it's got to be stopped. So who do I like in this race right now? Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I declared this months ago, and it comes
okay.
in, and even my friend said, Joe, he's too late. He'll never win, never do anything. John Kasich. Why John Kasich? I served with him. I was on the banking committee with him. I know who he is as an ethnic. He's an ethnic Croatian on his father's side. Father was a mailman. Grandfather was a coal miner. He's a two-term governor of Ohio, well-loved. He connected with the people, unlike Dukakis in 1988 when they said, well, what happens if your wife, you know, gets raped and you know, it's incest or whatever it was, and he didn't have a good answer. Look at the answer Kasich gave. He said, listen, I'm not one who would subscribe to, you know, the marriages or changing the word marriage for gay rights, and I'm probably one of them too. But you know what? I have many friends that are gay. I don't have a daughter that's gay or a son that's gay, but he answered it right. If my daughter was gay, I would love her. I went to a friend's wedding. I love this guy. He's gay. But you know what? That's not going to change my principles for America. So I would tell you, and by the way, when I left Congress, he was the one that carried on and became chairman of the Budget Committee, and he claims credit. I hope I could have called in on that debate. I would have said, hey, John, you didn't balance the budget using the right accounting system. You used the accounting system that Bill Clinton wanted you to use, which was the cash basis that Lyndon Johnson put us on back in 1968 to disguise the war, the cost of the war in Vietnam. That's
right.
What was being used, where you offset the surplus in Social Security against, you know, the cash basis deficits, and what do you get? A phony surplus. Now, I wouldn't, you know, say it that way because I like him, but he was using the rules that he couldn't change in Congress. But he did say, I'd like to have a balanced budget. But you know what? Everybody that says that, I hate to say, is not really saying the truth. Why? Because the balanced budget would be on the wrong accounting system. You'd never know what the real answers were. So, number one on my list would be John Kasich, all right, Ohio. And when you look at his state, one of the top two states to have in a Republican election, correct? You know, you got Florida and Ohio. And when you look at his background, his credentials, and he didn't do too badly as a spokesman on Fox either, I would tell you we got a long-distance runner here. He came in late. My friend said, Joe, you're kidding. He has no chance. He announced too late. And look what he did at that debate. He's already within the top five or six, like Carly Fiorina, who I like, too, because of her executive background and her feistiness. And I also like Don Trump. He's a friend of mine. We belong to Wingfoot Golf Club together. I've known him from the early 70s when our kids, my daughter Kara, who you probably know, that you know, American Idol, she was singing on Sundays at Wingfoot in the late 70s, and he brought his kids there, and he heard her, you know, singing the tracks from Annie, what was it, Grease. That's how bright Kara was. She would memorize the whole tracks. And that's how we got to know each other, through my daughter. And, you know, it's funny, because when they had the Tennis Open in 2010, I was running for the U.S. Senate. I think it was 2010, because I asked him for support, and he gave it to me. And he decided he wanted my daughter to escort him on the last Sunday at the Open in Flushing. And would you believe it? Because he remembered her, and he calls me. And what am I going to say? I say, hey, she's married. Well, you know, I just felt I love Kara. She's a great artist. And I said to Kara, you know what? I think he's going to test you for Apprentice. I think this is what this is all about. And sure enough, I'm not going to get through the whole story, but it's funny. I like Donald. Why do I like him? He's never going to be president. I mean, let's face it. If you don't come somewhere closer to the center, you cannot win, you know, in a nation that's so divided 50-50. But why do I love him? He's shaking up everybody. We need it. We need to shake up the political system. It's not working. You got politicians more worried about getting elected than giving you the right numbers for where the country stands right now, or worried about the next generation. Just look at the last transportation bill just passed in the House. 3 months, a patch, and we're worried about roads collapsing, bridges collapsing, and everything else. Rick, we're in tough shape. Now, Rand Paul, like his father, he's a wonderful guy, honest. I like him for everything that you like him for. But I have to tell you, he needs to talk about the issue of fiscal responsibility, financial accountability, and those things that are really important for the growth of this economy and the future of our country.
Well, and you know, that's an interesting thing because, again, I believe that he is – leading a legitimate movement on a lot of different issues. Let's get back to Trump in a second here. I first want to zoom in because I live in the state of Ohio. So I am, of course, very familiar with Governor John Kasich. And this diminishes none of my wide respect for you, Joe. You and I part company on the man, not merely because he has the demeanor of a less tactful Don Rickles, but I'm sure you followed what he did in this state, muscling through the Medicaid expansion, not through the legislature, but through that stupid loophole with the controlling board. So I look at the man's record, and now I will tell you this. Chairman of the House Budget Committee in the late 90s, I do agree with you. Very good job there. Not so impressed with what he's done in Ohio, so I respect you.
But he's on a banking committee. He was on a banking committee with me, so I saw him as somebody who was not only smart but sympathetic to coming up with solutions, practical solutions.
Okay.
Now, how did he win twice in Ohio by such large margins if he's not, you know, doing his job? I mean, he is a governor.
Well, once, the first time was by a hair past Ted Strickland, who was a very unsuccessful governor who still almost got reelected. And then I'm sure you know the circumstances last year being his friend. Ed Fitzgerald was a complete joke. He collapsed with a sex scandal in the middle of the campaign, was pretty much disavowed by the Democratic Party. It was basically a complete collapse on the part of his opponent. Nevertheless, it allowed Kasich to rack up these margins. He's running all over the country. I won 86 out of 88 counties in Ohio. And, of course, he's counting on people not looking into the circumstances.
Such as Ohio, not able then to come up with better competition. You tell me.
Well, our Republican Party stinks, to be quite honest with you. I know some Republican activists through the course of this campaign across the country. There's a Facebook friend that I've made recently who I still don't really know personally, but a very nice lady in Nevada, and I look at the stuff on her Facebook page, and I envy her for apparently having a Republican Party that she wants to be a part of. I'm thinking, geez, lady, if you lived in Ohio, you'd throw up your hands in disgust the way that I do, because it's all sort of a corrupt, inbred pack in this state. But, again, diminish none of my respect for you and getting behind the man. You have a relationship with him, you understand him a different way.
These are very preliminary observations. I'm behind him because I know him. I know what I need to see for the future of America, and I know that as budget chairman, he understands what I just told you. So I would tell you that right now, I would be leaning to hear more from him. Don't forget, he just came out of the box. I don't talk to him on the phone. I did call one of his former staff people, in Ohio, and I knew he was going to announce a month ago, and I said, hey, well, let him call me. He didn't call me, but that doesn't mean I'm not paying attention. Now, we have a lot of other people in this race. And if you want to go over the list, you know, why didn't George Bush and Scott Walker come off better than they did? You would think, you know, they should be prepared when they come to these debates to really hone in on the question and give clear answers. Now, they weren't bad, but they didn't really, you know, face the issues as well as they should have. Rubio did, and I think Rubio is still someone you got to admire. His background, he's articulate, and, you know, he is Hispanic, and you know, it seems to me that you can't write him off. Christie, I think the baggage from the bridge is so much that even though I like him as a person and his own state now is disavowing him, I don't see how he's going to come out of that one. Carly Fiorina, well, let's face it. She's one who's done very well in business. She's articulate. I think she's feisty enough to stand toe-to-toe with anybody, and she is a woman, and I think the GOP has to look at that because of what's going on these days, you know, with us being, you know, condemned at the Republican Party for being against women, which is really a lot of nonsense. And I don't think you should divide this country by anything. I'm one who doesn't even believe in the parties. We divided ourselves by parties, by race, by ideology, by gender, and you know what, Rick? The real enemies are outside America, and they're laughing. We got to get together here. And maybe Trump is going to shake everybody up so that they understand that. I hope so.
Well, you're preaching to the choir on that. I am somebody who will identify only reluctantly as a Republican. I'm not a partisan guy. I'm a very ideological guy. I'm interested in issues. Many of them track with the Republican Party. Unfortunately, not all of them do. The one thing I want to say is, and after this, I'll quit beating the drum for my boy, but I want to circle it back to what you said about Jeb Bush and Scott Walker. By the way, I believe it was a Freudian slip. You referred to him as George Bush. I think that's why he didn't do better that night, because he reminds us all.
But you know what?
His
father was so good,
Joe,
to me, you have no idea. Even after the CFO bill was signed by him, he sends me a personal note, you know, a Dear Joe note. So I probably, that was a good slip.
Well, you know, since he probably is W Redux, I can understand that. But, you know, you're wondering why they didn't do better. To a guy like me, and it's all about the perspective that you come from my perspective, it's because their most important thing is to get elected. And I have to tell you that the difference that I see, I got into a little bit of a debate on Facebook with somebody just yesterday who was questioning about You know, why did Rand Paul support Mitch McConnell? Whatever. I said, you know what? I said, Rand Paul is not somebody the establishment wants anywhere near the White House. I'm in favor of whatever he can do to neutralize whatever part of the establishment, because when he gets in there, he's getting in there to lead a movement. He's calling the shots. He's not going to be controlled by the establishment. That's how I look at it. And I want to just, and this is high praise, I think, for him and for you, because there's not too many politicians I can think of where I would say they don't want to get elected to pursue their agenda. They have ideas. They want to implement their ideas. They're not right. there just to get elected. And I certainly believe that about you, Joe. When I look at your track record, you know,
Thank you.
A tough district in New York. You made it in there as long as you could, standing by your ideals. And I've always saluted you for
that.
Yeah,
until Dukakis wins New York in 1988, the presidential race, you know, and the Republican Party abandoned New York. It's amazing. You know, New York is such a tough place for conservative Republicans, as you know.
Right.
But let me tell you, your guy, how can you not like Rand Paul when he stood up, you know, for that filibuster? I think it was. Yeah, he did. And he's done so many things on the House floor to challenge the process right in front of him. You know, and so I say to myself, he's a great guy, and I liked him like his father. His father, you know, had the sense of the monetary system being fraudulent, and Rand doesn't talk about that enough. And the father was a fiscal conservative par excellence. Now Rand, I think, needs to do a bit more on that, because our biggest problem today is accountability. We're not being accountable to the people today or the next generation. And it's very easy when you see accounting, basic accounting, is not being followed by the Congress of the United States of America and the GAO, you know, the big watchdog we have, the Government Accountability Office with the Comptroller General. They're forced to adhere to the laws. You know, Congress doesn't change things. They can't change things. It's not like you have an independent auditor. I've been calling for independent audits for years. But you're not going to see independent auditors, because they'll use every excuse. Oh, they're too expensive. They don't want independent eyes to see the gimmickry that they're using every day just to get elected, or every year. And that's the problem we have, Rick. Now, Rand Paul, I'm wide open my mind for him. I as a person, I love him. But I still say that John Kasich is a long-distance runner here who just came out of the box. And you got to watch him now. I think he's going to be in that top few. Who that few is going to be as they whittle themselves down, you know, who knows, but definitely he's going to be one of the top five. And Trump
Absolutely.
Probably stay up there, you know, because the people are so entertained by him and are so interested that he is saying so many things that they've been believing quietly that they didn't have the nerve to say, you know, about the system being, you know, rigged and some incompetent politicians are controlling the system, that nobody can really deal for America. I could do a much better job. Look what I did in New York City when I got those rebates to take the Commodore Hotel, a broken-down hotel, and I did that. And then when I did Trump Tower, I took down the Bomb with Teller building, and they were trying to get me to slow it down. They had those gargoyles up there in limestone. I said, that's not art. That's limestone. He didn't even wait till the Art Commission. He just took them down. You know what? Sometimes you need someone who's decisive. Now, is he honest? I think he is. Is he educated? For sure. He went to Wharton, graduated with honors. At 13, he went to a New York Military Academy. This guy's no dummy, believe me. And he's one that I think will continue to dominate the press until somebody comes along, and somebody will come along, because I don't think he's going to be the nominee for president, okay? And he said he has leverage. Let's hope he doesn't pull what George Perot what Ross Perot did in 1991 or 92, but that's because he had a vengeance against the Bushes for some oil deals that didn't go right. I don't think that's what Donald Trump is all about.
Well, let me ask you about this, because you mentioned something before, and it was sort of unintentionally hilarious, because you mentioned about how you don't think Trump will win because the American people don't really kind of sort of cotton to the extremes and things. Here's the funny thing about that, Joe, if you look at it. You take a political spectrum, whether it be liberal to conservative or whatever, the number zero on one end, 100 on the other. The funny thing is, if you just look at Donald Trump in the aggregate, there's a heck of a lot of 50s. Why? Because on many, many issues, and this is something that Rand Paul's been beating him up on this week, sometimes he's been a zero and sometimes he's been a 100 on the same issue at different points in time, depending on who was in there. The criticisms he made of George W. Bush are opposite from the criticisms that he made of Clinton, are opposite of the criticisms that he's making of Obama. Isn't that his biggest challenge right now, is consistency, as everyone starts to go out there and say, what do you really stand for? This is somebody that doesn't have an issues page on his website. You and I are big issues guys, Joe. So what do you say about that? I mean, you know, he's,
so I
not,
say,
he's not running as a
question. What a set of questions for me, who sent him an email last week. Don't forget, I know him. I says, Donald, you know, congratulations on your success right now in the Republican primary process. Now, as a friend, as someone, you know, who belongs to the same club with you, Wingfoot, and he belongs to many other clubs besides I do, he said, I said, let me tell you, immigration is important. Legal immigration is the issue. There's no question. My parents came here as immigrants, so I know that. But you need to now go on, and I mentioned five issues. I mentioned the issue of the bogus budget process that just gave us a three-month patch for transportation. Can you imagine? On bridges, they left with a three-month patch again, full of gimmicks. Number two, I said the fraudulent accounting system. We still don't know what the real national debt is. Number three, I said, Donald, you got to look at economic solutions for growth, and that means a tax reform package, not like Hillary Clinton that just wants to raise taxes right away and starts off with, you know, capital gains taxes. You got to start articulating that, you know, as well. And I said, look at the criminal justice system. It is so inefficient. It is so expensive. We got more people in jail than anybody else in the world, and that's got to be looked at. So I gave him those four, and I said, listen, I hope your handlers, and I know who they are, I don't know who, if you have any, I said, start looking at some of these, because if you want to be treated seriously, and I want you to be treated seriously because I know how bright you are, you know, and I know you don't need to borrow money from anybody, and you don't have to depend on anybody's money, thank God, because we've got too much of that going on in Washington. I said, I hope your handlers will now make sure that you have a tripod or a group of things to put under your stool for policy and issues, because I think the people like you, that's important, and now they got to understand that you're qualified from a, you know, how would you say, not intellectual, he's a good intellectual in many ways, but from a policy and procedural point of view, to become the commander-in-chief of this country. You know, I told him that.
Well,
let's see who
I'll
comes back.
What.
I don't know whether he will respond or somebody who's carrying him, but I did that just a few days ago.
Joe, you need to let it be known if there is a response, because I'll tell you what, there's a lot of us that, right now, that would never think of voting for the guy based on his mirage of contradictory statements on many issues. If there was a chance at all of you being in his ear, I'd feel a lot better about things, and so would anybody who knows you. So
you
that's
know
an encouraging thing.
I don't write him off completely. I've said to some of my friends, I said, you know what, he may not be president, but if he plays his cards right and he uses that leverage, he loves that word, he could be our Secretary of Treasury. And in that case, he'd have a lot to do with the Fed, with trade, and a lot of things that have to do with numbers. And maybe we need a guy like that. We've had Rubin. We've had Paulson. And what did they do? They just did deals for their friends at Goldman Sachs. We don't need any more of that.
No. No, we don't. What I want to ask you about, though, I've developed a theory, and it's interesting you mentioned Paulson because he indirectly is part of it. When you look at it right now, and again, you know and I know, we've talked about this before on the show, the economy, at least on the surface, not as bad as it was when Obama came into office. There have been a lot of Fed tricks, smoke and mirrors, whatever, to make that happen. And again, the underemployed part of the population, people that aren't even being counted for unemployment because they've been off the rolls so long,
yes,
the unemployment statistics are phony. But on paper, this is not a moment when you would think people would be as angry as 2009, as 2006 with the Iraq war still going on, whatever. My theory is there's fatigue going on in this country that I don't think we've had a single day that's as good as the day that we had September 10th, 2001. 9/11 rolled into Iraq, rolled into the economic downturn.
Right.
I think we've had 14 years of this crap, and people are going, when is it going to get any better? And, you know, you're always susceptible to the whole white man on, or I'm sorry, a man on a white horse. I almost got that backwards, unfortunately. A man on a white horse riding in promising to save the day. How much of this is just a cumulative frustration of 14 years of just unending crap, seemingly?
Well, you know what the answer is, and I think it's more simple than you think. It's the uncertainty that we have today. It's like we're in uncharted waters. The market keeps going up and down. China once, you know, was 10%, now it's down to 7%. People think it's going to collapse. You saw what happened to Europe, even the UK right now. The Scottish National Party, you know, took over, and no one thought that could happen. So there's such uncertainty in the world, especially in America, about what's going on. People are open now to new people, new ideas, and to people who, you know, speak with a sense of certitude. And isn't that Donald Trump? Whether he's right or wrong, he makes you feel like he's got the answers, correct? So, you know, they've heard so much double talk coming out of Washington, I think that they can be easily seduced by someone who is not, you know, who's telling the truth, and I believe Donald is, but who says it in a way that everybody on Main Street can understand. So I think that's what's going on here. We have too much uncertainty, and it may be worse than you think when you look at the real numbers. And the fact that we don't have the real numbers tells you why people see even more uncertainty. So I'll leave it with that, but I'll leave it with one more thing, Rick, for the members of your show, your listeners. Mm-hmm. Anybody who wants my book, Unaccountable Congress, it's sold on Amazon, but I have a foundation. I give it away every time I speak at universities, sometimes high schools, anywhere, rotaries. I would be glad if someone sent me an email to JJD, my initials, at truthingovernment.org. I will send them a free copy of Unaccountable Congress. It doesn't add up. My role now in life, I'm going to be 75 in September. I may not sound it. My daughter is going to be 45, and they all think she's 25. Thank God we have some good genes from the old sod in Italy, you know, from those high mountaintops where they breathe that fresh air and only ate vegetables. Yep. Whatever it was, I hope to live another 20 years like my mom. But the point is, I'm going to be a spokesman for the rest of my life, like a missionary, on this issue. So if your listening audience wants to know why I'm so passionate as a CPA, former congressman, and now an activist, just send me an email, and I'll send you a copy of my book. And you know what the preface of that book is? The story of America. Joey the waiter goes to Washington. That's me. I work my way through college as a waiter in the richest country clubs in Westchester County.
It's a great story. It definitely is. And, again, multi-generationally, of course, for anybody that's been to diaguardi.org, as you noted there, with your daughter and her new family of the last couple of years as well. Of course, somebody beloved to a lot of people from her time as a judge on American Idol and an incredibly successful songwriter, to be sure. Last question I want to ask you there, staying close to home, so to speak, and that would be, sitting there in New York, and again, you had the experience of dealing with somebody in 2010, part of the Clinton machine up there, the Democratic machine, and Kirsten Gillibrand in the Senate race there. What do you think is going through the minds at Clinton world right now as all this stuff is happening, as your friend Donald Trump is wreaking havoc on the Republican field? Based on your insights in the arena, in New York state politics, what do you think they're thinking right now?
Well, I can tell you that many of my friends who consider themselves progressives, and I hang around with a lot of different people, I just don't go to, you know, one club versus another, they are really excited about Bernie Sanders. I understand that he turned out 30,000 people plus in L.A. last night, and before that, 28,000. I'd have to say that Hillary Clinton has to be very worried about that. The fact that he is resonating, you know, someone who they called a socialist, someone he claims he's independent. Now, would I agree with him on a lot of his fiscal policies? No, but you know what? The guy is as honest as they come. He's a dedicated public servant, and he's making an impact. But I can tell you that has to get her, you know, really going. The other person that's got to get her really going is what's going on with Trey Gowdy and Benghazi. He's not going to let up. He's like the Judicial Watch. I'm a member of Judicial Watch. I send him, you know, a couple of $100 every now and then. I love what Tom Fitton's doing. You know, I want to see more freedom of information, you know, lawsuits going, which he's doing. And guess what? He's getting stuff that no one's gotten, even on the IRS, the stuff with the conservatives having been unfairly chosen for audit. And now he's getting more stuff from the IG of the State Department on Hillary Clinton. He's one of the few things I read besides Cato and a few others so I can stay in touch with what the hell is going on down there. So she's got to be really worried because now the IG has picked up four emails that were classified in that batch that she sent in. Now, how many more are there? So I have a feeling she has no chance, none, of becoming the candidate for the Democratic Party. Not only is her honesty factor now, dishonesty factor, above 60%, but people are still saying they'd vote for her. Why? You've got some woman who feels it's time for a woman. Well, maybe Carly Fiorina will fill that boat for some of them who are not, you know, way to the left on that scale. I don't know. But you know what? This is exciting. This is America. This is what it's all about, competition. If we were in China right now, you'd have one candidate to vote for. And it wouldn't come
exactly.
up until probably a few weeks before. Here it is, a year and a half before, and look at what we got. So I think we should celebrate the fact that we've got such competition and so many good people running, including your man, Rand Paul, and so far my guy, Kasich. But let Trump stay in. The more he stays in, the more we're going to get at the truth, I believe.
Well, I want to just mention in closing there with what you said about Bernie Sanders, because, again, on the overwhelming majority of policy positions of his, I would not be in agreement with him. Having said that, I did get that great book from that Ralph Nader had put out about left-right alliances strategically on different issues. To me, Rand Paul's the only guy on either side trying to build a new coalition, but Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders will, from time to time, have some overlap on issues, which I think makes them both more interesting. Opposing the China deal and the giveaway to China right there, that's one of them. So sometimes there can be these odd bedfellows, Joe, on different issues. My favorite congressman, Justin Amash and Thomas Massey, who are both kind of sidekicks of Rand Paul, I think they exemplify that. They make odd couple coalitions to get legislation passed on things they agree with all the time. So Bernie Sanders, in a tiny way, at least represents that as well, I think.
Rick, I love odd couples who are honest, who are competent, who are public servants, and I was great at doing that. If I didn't bond with the head of the Black Caucus, Mickey Leland, who went to give food to Ethiopia in 1989 after I left Congress, and he died on a plane crash, but I bonded with him early to get Congressional Medals of Honor for black war heroes, African-American war heroes, that were denied our nation's highest award in World War I and World War II. When I found out, because I had a very large black population in Mount Vernon, New Rochelle, and Yonkers, that's why my district has never had a Republican and never will have a Republican. But I was there for two terms. When I found out about this, I didn't know why. And I said to myself, I'm a CPA. These numbers don't add up. 1,550,000 black Americans serve, and not one gets the Medal of Honor. It's called the Medal of Honor. And hundreds have been recommended. And then I find out we had segregation in World War I and World War II. I didn't know that. I'm a poor kid from the Bronx who moved to Westchester when I was 15. My old man, I was raised in the back of a grocery store in the South Bronx. So, you know, I love America because of the opportunity, but I didn't know that, but I fought it, and guess what? Obama invites me to the White House June 2nd, and the guy I started with in 1986, Sergeant Henry Johnson from Albany, New York, World War I, got the medal, and I was there. But I was also there when George W. Bush invited me in January, in April of 1991, when we gave it to Corporal Freddie Stowers. So I'm responsible for the only two medals given to war heroes in World War I. And believe me, Rick, there are many more. I'm not going to stop. We've had racial injustice in America on war heroes. They happen to be black. And at a time we have all this black racial stuff going on, why aren't we bending over backwards to praise those who were heroes? You know what Pericles said 500 B.C. when he spoke at the funeral of a Greek soldier that was killed in one of the Spartan Wars? He said, shame on the country that has no heroes, but more shame on the country that has heroes and doesn't honor them. I'll leave you with that. So that was one odd couple I had with my good friend.
Bringing it around on a high note. Yeah, very uplifting and great work. And again, and that's the kind of thing we really need more of in this country. And whether or not we get it after the 2016 elections, we can only hope. But, of course, again, everyone can continue to track your great work going on at truthingovernment.org.
Yes.
Joe DiGuardi, great former congressman. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and look forward to continuing to catch up with you through the course of this campaign, talk about what's being discussed, what should be discussed. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day, as always.
Thank you, Rick. Keep it going.
Excellent.
Bye.
Thank you. We will certainly do that. Thank you, Joe. Take care, and thank you, everyone, for tuning in today to mini-episode 587 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.